Families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In Pakistan, A.Q. Khan is considered to be a national hero for his role in setting up Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. But to much of the rest of the world, he has been the leading black market dealer in nuclear technology. In fact, for people who track the problem of nuclear proliferation, they would say that A.Q. Khan, perhaps more than any other single individual, has been responsible for spreading nuclear technology over the past couple of decades. But one important thing to understand about A.Q. Khan is that he was not a rogue operator. He did what he did with the full knowledge of elements in Pakistan's government and in the government of the United States. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with investigative journalist Catherine Scott Clark. She is the co-author of a recently published book that explores this territory. The title is Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. The book is published by Walker and Company. Certainly you can find it in the bookstore. Her co-author on the book is Adrian Levy. They're internationally known and award-winning investigative journalists. They've worked for the Sunday Times of London, and they were there for 7 years, and then they joined the staff of The Guardian as senior correspondents, and they have written a good deal about South Asia, meaning India, Pakistan, and they now make their home in both London and France, and she's speaking with us this morning from France. So we'll be talking about some of what you'll find in Deception. Perhaps also we talk a little bit about recent developments in Pakistan. Ms. Scott Clark, hello. Thanks for talking with us.
It's nice to be here.
We certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Certainly, the three basic questions that we want to talk about, and they are certainly things that I'm sure could keep us talking for some time, but at least we'll try to hit the high points here to start out. What did A.Q. Khan do? Who in the Pakistani government knew about it, and what did the United States know? Starting with the first, if you go back and look at this man's life, it seems to me, when you look at his origins, a little unlikely that he would end up being the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb. How exactly did that come about?
Well, he's a very interesting character, and we spent a lot of time with his former psychiatrist who knew him right from the early 80s up until 2004 when he was kind of taken down by Musharraf. And his psychiatrist characterized him almost as a kind of Hitler-type figure who had a messiah complex, that he would do great things for his nation, but in his earlier life he was actually a very average student, and he didn't look like he was really going anywhere. The turning point came when he failed miserably to get a job in Pakistan, having made multiple applications, and he decided to go and sleep on the floor of a relative in Europe, in Germany. And over the next couple of years, he managed to do a few university courses, which brought him by 1972 to a very junior job within a consortium of nuclear powers, Britain, Holland, and Germany, who were developing a very revolutionary and very secret new technology to enrich uranium. And his job at this company was actually to be a technical translator, but he was such a fantastic linguist that he spoke all the languages of all of the documentation that was flooding into his office. And part of the secrecy policy of this company was to not put everything in one language, and of course he spoke all three. So he realized that this technology was potentially something you could use to enrich uranium to weapons grade. So he stole blueprints from the company and flew back to Pakistan in December 1975 with his suitcases full of information.
Hmm. I think, you know, one of the questions that many people have asked about A.Q. Khan has to do with his motivation and whether he was motivated by patriotism or at some point he became motivated simply by greed. And perhaps the answer to both questions is yes, and then maybe it depends upon at what point in time you're talking about. Do you come away with, or did you come away with a feeling that you did indeed have an answer to that question of what was it that was driving him?
Well, certainly what was driving him in the early days when he stole the technology was patriotism, because what we have to remember is that India testified a nuclear device in 1974, and everything and anything that Pakistan has done since it was established in 1947 has been aimed at destroying India, or that they live in fear of their Hindu neighbour. I mean, India is a far greater power than Pakistan, both financially and militarily and economically. And the minute that India testified a nuclear device, the Pakistanis were terrified and thought that the only way to respond is to get one of our own. So part of Khan's methodology was, because he was already a scientist of sorts, was to try and get himself into a position where he could help that desire to get nuclear technology for Pakistan. I mean, the then Prime Minister, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the father of Benazir, had made several very well-known public statements about Pakistani people needing to even go to the lengths of eating grass if it meant that would help them get nuclear policy. They would have to give everything up. So Khan, who already had kind of cast himself into a central role in Pakistan's history, although he hadn't even done anything at that stage, he saw his opportunity. If he could get close to some kind of technology which would help build Pakistan to build the bomb, then that would make him the man of the moment. And he succeeded.
Certainly, for some time there has been concern about the spread of nuclear weapons technology and know-how. And when you look at what it is that he did, and apparently how easy it was for him to steal what was secret information and take it from this European company, take it back to Pakistan, you have to wonder why security was so lax, and whether in fact this was an issue of very poor security, or was it that here we just happened to have someone who was uniquely positioned to do this, and that he decided to take advantage of that position?
I think we've got to remember it was a different world order in the early 70s. I mean, the existing nuclear powers then, which was Britain, America, France, China and Russia, all had plutonium-based nuclear weapons programs. And those programs, plutonium-based nuclear weapons, it was very difficult to get into that for any other country, because to get hold of plutonium to use that as a fissile material, you needed to have a breed reactor. You needed large installations that would be visible from aerial reconnaissance, that were tracked by the International Atomic Energy Association, in Vienna. All trade in the materials you needed to put those kind of plants together was controlled, was heavily policed. So I guess in the case of Urenco, which was the European consortium that Khan ended up working at, there was a sort of slightly lackadaisical attitude, because this was such an experimental time, and enriching uranium had been tried in America and had been tried by a few other countries, but no one had succeeded. So it hadn't really, it was still sort of early days. But I mean, if you look at the Dutch investigative reports that were conducted sort of after Khan actually took the material away and the theft was discovered, I mean, some of the security lapses were unbelievable. The fact that the most secretive section of this company, where all of the blueprints were held, all the most sort of highly classified technical data was held in a warehouse, but because it was such a small site, the canteen for all of the staff, from low-grade security to top-grade security, was in the same building. So everyone kind of wandered through, and Khan took advantage of the fact that if you put a white coat on and you seemed to know what you were talking about, then the other highly qualified and classified scientists presumes that you were kind of one of them, and they talked very freely. And he described it much later on as being an extremely easy exercise to sit at night in these laboratories copying down blueprints for enrichment technology, and people just said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm writing a letter home to my father." And the security guards would say things like, "Oh, okay, that's good." And so, yes, I mean, it was a different time, but he was very wily in his approach.
Just to very quickly introduce again our guest, Catherine Scott Clark. She's an investigative journalist. She works for The Guardian, a British newspaper, has been covering South Asia for now more than 10 years, and she is the co-author of a newly published book, Pakistan, dealing with Pakistan, the U.S., and the secret nuclear weapons trade overseen by A.Q. Khan. And the title of the book is Deception, and it's published by Walker & Company. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, just jumping ahead then to the early part of 2004, when A.Q. Khan confessed on television, live television in Pakistan, that he had been involved in this network of proliferation that had indeed provided information to Libya and Iran and North Korea. When that happened, I think some people might say said something like, well, helping to make Pakistan a nuclear power was bad enough, but selling this technology on to anyone who would pay the price is clearly something else altogether. And the question is, what did the government of Pakistan know about A.Q. Khan and his network and what he was doing?
Well, they knew everything. I mean, this is the ridiculous nature of what happened in 2004, because soon after Khan was put on television and then made to make his kind of mea culpa and fall on his sword, several U.S. Administration officials went to Pakistan and talked to Musharraf and members of his military administration and said, what are we going to do about the proliferation? And basically, they were told that this is the act of one man. He had a few assistant scientists working with him, but now we've closed him down. We've put them under house arrest. The issue is over, and the proliferation has stopped. Well, the proliferation hasn't stopped, but more importantly, if you go back in time and you look at how those sales began life in 1990, then it becomes clear that that every military ruler of Pakistan and the civilian rulers of Pakistan through the 1990s, and in fact all U.S. administrations since 1990, have known that Pakistan was selling this technology and have done nothing about it. I mean, a critical phase for Pakistan's proliferation activities came at the end of the war, the U.S. war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, when the last Soviet soldiers left Kabul in February 89. 10 years of large amounts of U.S. funding ended overnight. And when the chief of the army staff in Pakistan discovered that America was about to leave Pakistan in the lurch after 10 years, he sought out three senior U.S. officials, including the then ambassador, Bob Oakley, and also Norman Schwarzkopf, who's then head of CENTCOM and a Pentagon official. And he said, look, if you leave us in the lurch, we're going to be completely broke. And I warn you now, the only thing that's going to keep us going economically is our nuclear technology, which we're going to sell. And we've already primed our first customer, and our first customer is going to be Iran. So evidence is coming in all the way through the 90s that Iran was being sold technology, and Libya was being sold technology, and North Korea was being sold technology, and China was getting in on the act by sending over bomb designs that Pakistan would then kind of subcontract and sell on elsewhere. But no one really in the West wanted to deal with this issue. I mean, it was just too big and too much of a mess. And Pakistan, by the time Pakistan then became an ally again after 2001 and the downing of the World Trade Center towers, then really the proliferation activities were pushed under the carpet until they became so well known and talked about that something had to be done. And Khan was chosen as the fall guy.
So the motivation for people who were in the government of Pakistan for selling this technology, it was all about the money?
Primarily, it was money to start with. I mean, the chief of army staff I mentioned earlier, who was a general called Mirza Aslan Beg, he was a money man. He could see that Pakistan's foreign reserves were not going to keep the country afloat once American funding pulled out in 1990. But at the same time, he and the head of the intelligence services had got together to draw up what they described as a strategic consensus paper slightly earlier, in about 89, whereby Pakistan sensing that America was a fair-weather friend and would come in and throw money when Pakistan was needed strategically in the region and would leave when Pakistan wasn't needed, they set about looking for an alternative source of allies. And they came up with this idea of having basically a Muslim arc of influence which would spread from the end of Europe in Turkey through Iran, through Afghanistan to Pakistan, which would primarily be for Pakistan's benefit to be a threat towards India. But it would also mean that Pakistan had Muslim friends, Islamic friends in neighbouring powers that they could call upon if they were ever left out on their own. And the primary way that relationship would be oiled, so to speak, would be through nuclear technology and the sale of nuclear technology. I mean, North Korea doesn't quite fit into that model, but that was a purely financial exercise. But it was led by money, but it was also oiled by the desire to have alternative friends from America.
What do you know, and do the people who have investigated this know the full extent of this proliferation? We mentioned a number of countries that benefited, the Libya, Iran, North Korea, but I guess it was my understanding that at least it's something of an open question about where all of this technology and know-how might have gone.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, we don't know. We know that, for example, that Pakistan agreed to give Saudi Arabia a warhead, a ready-made warhead. They didn't want the wherewithal to enrich uranium to weapons grade. They just wanted a warhead. Whether they got a warhead or not, nobody knows. The same as Syria, who had talks to Pakistan about buying nuclear technology. The problem is because the whole proliferation racket was blamed on AQ Khan, and both London and Washington accepted Musharraf's version of events that this was only one man's operation. Nobody has been able outside Pakistan to interview any of these people to get to the truth as to how far they went and who else they talked to. I mean, Musharraf said a year ago, in 2006, he said that Pakistan had conducted an extremely deep investigation into the proliferation activities of AQ Khan and other nuclear scientists within Pakistan, and they had concluded that there would be no charges and no one would be sent to jail. But all of this is based on a kind of it's like a one-sided situation, because no one in the West gets to see any of the evidence that leads Musharraf to that conclusion. No one gets to see what AQ Khan has said about his visits to Syria or to Saudi Arabia. So it's very much we have to take Musharraf's word for it. And that has meant that the proliferation activities are probably still continuing. We don't know, as you say, the extent to which they went with other countries. And I think has become clear in recent weeks in the West, particularly in America, that Musharraf is not someone you can trust.
Yeah, I think here you really make an important argument in this book. And that is, you know, by observing how important Pakistan has been, at least to the government of the United States and its international agenda, going back to the Carter administration. First, when the Soviets were in Afghanistan, Pakistan was important as a conduit for transferring aid to the Mujahideen that were fighting against the Soviets. And then there was this intervening period where we didn't care about Pakistan. And then after 9/11, in what the United States calls the War on Terror, it became very important again in the United States in its effort to go after al-Qaeda. So you hear the central argument, though, that you make is that in our attempt to maintain the goodwill and the cooperation of the government of Pakistan and several regimes that have been in power over all that time, we have ended up either creating or making worse a lot of other problems. And in fact, if you take a look at all of the difficulties and the concerns and the worries that the United States has about the world and international security, right at the center of an awful lot of this is Pakistan.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the one nation that has an unsecured nuclear weapons program that gives safe haven to Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, and yet we call it our sort of primary ally. I mean, part of the problem, I think, is through this feast and famine type of relationship with Pakistan is that, unfortunately, by dint of nature of what's happened, events in Pakistan, that both times that America, the US, and Europe has cozied up to Pakistan and thrown a lot of money at it in recent history have been periods of military dictatorship. So in the 80s, when billions, $10 billion, $10 billion a year was being sent from the US to Pakistan, the man in charge was General Zia ul Haq, who was the chief of the army who hanged Benazir Bhutto's father, Zulfikar. And in obviously since 9/11, the man in charge has been General Musharraf, again a military man, of a chief of army staff until 2 days ago. So I think that has partially caused a problem for our relationship, that we've always had a military man, a general in charge. But in a way, that has also helped the West, in that both times Pakistan has been needed, it's been needed to fight wars on our behalf. The first time, I'd characterise what happened in Afghanistan as more than aid. It was fighting a proxy war in Afghanistan, as well as the $10 billion a year going in, also undisclosed amounts in CIA aid, and again now with $10 billion US dollars again since 2001 to fight the war on terror, which is a war. So it's very easy for military officials in Washington, in the Pentagon, to ring up Islamabad and speak to military officials in Musharraf's government. I mean, they speak the same language, but that means that Pakistan's kind of democratic future and recent history has totally taken a kind of sideline, which is why we see very, very weak democratic party at the moment and very sort of half-hearted attempts by Musharraf to get Pakistan's democracy back on track with Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif coming back into the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about at our midpoint here, and again, I want to say that if you're interested in reading the story in much greater detail, you should look for the book Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. It is co-authored by Adrian Levy and our guest, Catherine Scott Clark. They both work for The Guardian as senior correspondents. They've been reporting from South Asia for more than 10 years. The book is out now in the bookstore. Walker & Company is the publisher, so you can certainly find it. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I hope that you wouldn't mind if perhaps I ask you a few questions about recent events in Pakistan, and beginning with something just quite recent, in fact. There has been, and as I'm sure that people know, and we've tried to talk a little bit about it on the show, there has been a good deal of unrest and confrontation over the past few months now between the president, General Musharraf, now no longer general, but President Musharraf, and the opposition in the country. One of the things that the opposition had been calling for a very long time was to have Mr. Musharraf resign his position as head of the army, something that finally he did do. So he has now been sworn in for a second term as the president, as a civilian. So the question is, well, just how important is that? He did indeed do this thing that the opposition had been asking for so long, but in terms of the country's politics and the reality of the country's politics, one wonders whether, in fact, this means much of anything.
I think it's purely a symbolic gesture, because we have to remember that he still remains the supreme commander of the Army of Pakistan, and the new head of the army, General Kayani, is a Musharraf man, as is the head of the intelligence services, most other senior officials, military officials in the country. So still he very much has the hand of control. But on the other hand, I would say that he has done this extremely reluctantly. I mean, he is a fighting man, as he says in his own autobiography, In the Line of Fire. I mean, he relishes a scrap. And after 46 years in the Pakistani army, he did not want to go. He did not want to be forced to do anything that suggested that other people were pressurizing him. I mean, he's a strong man, and he doesn't like to be seen as weak. And I read a quote from this week from his resignation speech, saying that the Army of Pakistan is the savior of Pakistan, and without it, the entity of Pakistan can't exist. I mean, this is it's a military world that he has existed in for the entire of his adult life, and I think he will feel very sore having to have so publicly given it up. But I also don't think it's anything to do with the opposition parties calling for him to take off his uniform. I think it's entirely pressure coming from Washington, because what we need to think about when we think about Musharraf is that the only thing that keeps him in power is military might and the $10 billion that's coming from Washington. I mean, he politically is a spent, well, he was never a real force anyway, but when the last time they held an election in 2002, with both the Democratic candidates out of the country in exile, he had to rig the elections and form a fake political party in order to win. And if you look at what's happened in the last few months when it comes to challenges to his actual presidency, aside from whether or not he's going to take his uniform off, in the only way he actually got sworn in for the second term as president on Thursday was having sacked his chief, the chief of the Supreme Court a few months ago, and reinstated all of the main significant positions within the Supreme Court with his men. And now the Supreme Court has honoured his presidential bid for a second term, and it's been confirmed, and we in the West have congratulated him as if it's like a man who steals a bicycle giving it back. I mean, everything that happens in Pakistan is very much staged. I mean, nothing is spontaneous. Everything has a cause and effect, and I think we'll see over the next few weeks that the only reason he let Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, both former prime ministers in the period of democracy that Pakistan had in the 90s, the only reason he let them back into the country after years in exile is that his hope is that they will fight each other to the point that come the elections in January, that people will not vote for them, but will vote for Musharraf's party.
Well, we have a couple of calls to bring into the conversation, so let's do that. And we'll start with someone in Arcola, and it's on our line number. They are on our line number one. Hello.
Yes. It seems like this situation in Pakistan is that the Pakistan's got us kind of over a barrel with either the war on terror or the fact that they have nuclear weapons, and they can evidently they've been able to sell the technology, and I'm just wondering, is there any way out of this in a rational way where we could get to a better situation with Pakistan? And the other question I have is the factor that we've been having overture with India, and how does it affect the Indian relationship and also the Pakistani relationship with the nuclear question, and I'll hang up and listen to your answers. Thank you.
All right.
I think, is there any way out of it? Yes, there definitely is a way out of it. America and Britain needs to start backing genuine attempts to bring democracy to Pakistan. The problem with Pakistan of today is that the military government has been propped up for so long that the democratic parties within Pakistan are so weak that they don't really have much of a chance. And Musharraf will always cite the terrible record of people like Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, who were both prime ministers twice in the 1990s and both ended up being accused of numerous corruption activities, some of which are definitely, undoubtedly true. But what he doesn't pinpoint for his own reasons, and what the West doesn't really seem to kind of take on board, is that they came into power at a time when Pakistan had been propped up militarily for a very long time. The military was all powerful, and when they took over, that assistance from the West had been rapidly withdrawn. So they were coming in at a very difficult time. And again now, I mean, the military is all powerful, and the longer that money is funneled into the Musharraf regime, the longer he will remain in power. Like I said earlier, the minute that you take the money away from him, then he will collapse. And, I mean, several people in Washington, very heavyweight Pakistan analysts in Washington, have said that there is a way out of Pakistan, which is that funding proper, genuine, democratic progress the kind of not-so-sexy headline-grabbing issues, such as making sure there are proper schools, making sure there are proper electoral rolls, making sure that political parties are able to function in tribal areas like the Northwest Frontier, where the Taliban are now kind of resurgent, and it's impossible to run a political office unless you're part of Musharraf's inner circle. These kind of things need to be, with the assistance of America and Britain, brought to the Pakistani people. I mean, we talk about the Pakistani people as if they're some kind of foreign breed, whereas they have the same conversations about what's happening in Pakistan as we do. And the one call that they always make is that they want to see some genuine efforts of forcing democracy on Pakistan. They want to be able to go out of their front door on January the 8th and vote for who they want to. They don't want to feel terrified on the way to the polling booth and find that they get there and that the paper's got three or four candidates missing, and that then they get a visit that night from someone knocking on the door saying, you voted for the wrong party. We need to back genuine democracy in Pakistan and stop backing Musharraf's phony democracy and saying, as Bush said this week, that he believes he's an absolutely reliable partner. This man is not a reliable partner, and if, and until America changes its attitude to Musharraf, I don't think there's a way out.
The caller was also asking about the relationship between India and the United States, and it seems to be the case that the Bush administration has been trying to establish closer ties with the government of India. In what way is that problematic, or is that problematic for the relationship between the United States and Pakistan?
I think, it heaps enormous pressure on Musharraf because we think of Pakistan as looking towards aiding the West with the war on terror, but what Pakistan's primary objective always has been and always will be looking east towards India. And anything that suggests that the US is turning its attention to India is very problematic for Musharraf. How the American-Indian relationship is going to develop is we will have to see in the future, but it's very interesting that they're talking about Washington's talking about giving assistance to the Indian civil nuclear program. And I think that would be a very good idea, and it will cause problems in Pakistan, though, because Pakistan will see it as a treacherous act. But I think it would be good for the West to spread its assistance around more in South Asia, and rather than being seen as very one-sided. I mean, the relationship still is very much one that existed in the Cold War days, when India was the ally of Russia and Pakistan was the ally of the West. So hopefully it will be a change of scenario in that region, but I think we have to see how it's going to play out.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana, and line two. Hello.
Hello. My understanding is that Musharraf was put in his position as head of the army by Nawaz Sharif, and then apparently there's some sort of falling out, and Musharraf ran a coup against Nawaz Sharif. What was the cause of that, and what was behind that?
That was in 1999 when Nawaz Sharif he became terrified by several messengers who said that his chief of army staff was going to try and depose him. And Musharraf was out of the country at a military conference in Sri Lanka, and as his plane was coming back to Karachi, the Karachi airport was closed down on the instructions of the Prime Minister, who tried to basically keep the plane flying until it ran out of fuel and crashed, which is slightly similar to the way that that Pakistan's last military dictator was got rid of, General Zia-ul Haq, who died in a mystery air crash in 1988, thought to be caused by a box of mangoes in which there was a hidden explosive device. But Nawaz Sharif, as has been evidenced throughout his political career, caved in at the last minute and allowed Musharraf to land. And within minutes, Musharraf had Nawaz Sharif and all of the senior government officials rounded up and put under house arrest, and in fact put into to prison later, and he was tried for treason and sentenced to life imprisonment. So it'll be very interesting to see whether or not they can reform any kind of relationship this time around. I mean, it's interesting to see at the moment that Sharif is saying that he won't stand in the elections in January. He's going to boycott them. I think he's absolutely scared of Musharraf and the fact that Musharraf bears a grudge against him. I mean, we talked to him a lot when he was Sharif, when he was in London in exile last year, and he said that he was frightened of going back to Pakistan. I think he's been forced to go back now because otherwise he's going to lose any chance of any kind of democratic, any kind of political comeback. But it'll be interesting to see whether the two can ever kind of sit in the same room again. And it would be fascinating if there was a government formed where the former head of the army, who was almost killed by the former prime minister, had to sit down as president and prime minister again.
Yes. Do you think these fears that Nawaz Sharif had about being deposed were groundless, or what was the cause? Why was Musharraf trying to depose him originally?
Part of the problem was over military strategy, because Musharraf wanted to fight a war against Kashmir, and Sharif didn't want to fight a war against Kashmir. I mean, part of Musharraf's mind military makeup is that he was born in India, in Delhi, and was forced to migrate to Pakistan at partition as a young child. And he has, throughout his military career, wanted to foment trouble in Kashmir, which is a divided state, half of which is administrated by Pakistan, half of it administered by India, which is in the northwest of Pakistan. And Musharraf has constantly wanted to ramp up trouble in Kashmir, first in the 80s and then in the early 90s with when Bhutto was the prime minister for the second time, and again in 1999 when he actually launched the Kargil offensive in May of 1999. And that caused great friction between Musharraf, who was the head of the army, as you say, and Sharif, who was the prime minister, because Sharif had, for the previous 3 or 4 months, been trotting off to New Delhi on a diplomatic offensive to try and kind of build bridges with the Indian Prime Minister, and had actually invited the Indian Prime Minister to Pakistan on a bus, the so-called bus diplomacy, where they shook hands on the border and re-established ties and transport links for the first time in years. And then while that was going on, Musharraf had been secretly plotting an offensive in Kargil, and which is a part of Kashmir, at which point Sharif had to go to America and say that he really didn't know anything about this military operation in Kashmir. It had been done without his say-so, and he wasn't really in control of it. So basically there were many reasons for him to fear Musharraf, not least that he was being made to look extremely weak in the eyes of Washington and look like he'd been a traitor to India.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and we're talking with Catherine Scott-Clark. She's an investigative journalist. She works for The Guardian, a British newspaper. She's been covering South Asia for more than a decade, and she is co-author, along with Adrian Levy, of the book Deception, Pakistan, the U.S., and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. And this book looks at A.Q. Khan, the man who is commonly called the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, how it is that he spearheaded that program, and also was responsible with the knowledge of the government of Pakistan of proliferating nuclear weapons know-how to other countries, and about how the United States certainly knew about that. And in a larger sense, it's about the problematic relationship between Pakistan and the United States. So the book is out now. It's published by Walker & Company. If you'd like to read it, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly, I think in the coverage that we get about the politics in Pakistan, the people who get the most attention are Mr. Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, and Nawaz Sharif, the general and the two former prime ministers. Now, one occasionally does hear about other people like Imran Khan, for example, the man who was a former Pakistani cricket star and also involved in Pakistan's opposition, and someone who does seem to have something of a clean and honest reputation. But if you ask this question, well, other besides the people that you hear about all the time, particularly Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, are there other people who are positioned, have some kind of base that they could draw on to perhaps constitute an effective kind of opposition to Musharraf?
Well, you've hit on a very key issue, which is that this time around with these elections, the short answer is no. And the main reason is because there has been no democratic freedom in Pakistan for 10 years. Sharif went into exile in 2000 after he was convicted for trying to kill his chief of army staff, and Bhutto went into exile the same year, accused of corruption, mass corruption, when she'd been prime minister. And at that point, Musharraf took over, had already taken over, and there was no democratic discussion about the military government for the whole of that time up until the last few months. I mean, if you look at what happened when Bhutto went back to Pakistan recently for the first time, I mean, she was a very flawed prime minister, let's be clear about this, but she and she'd lost a lot of supporters from her father's party, the Pakistan People's Party, because of what she'd done for personal greed in the 1990s. But when she went back to Pakistan after years in exile, and the Pakistan people had no political freedom for so long, I mean, they went out on the streets and they mobbed her because she just represented a voice in a vacuum of almost a decade. And because there has been that vacuum at the moment, there is very... I mean, I can think of countless people I know in Pakistan who could be future leaders at some stage in years to come. But because there has been no freedom, and because the traditional triumvirate of the military and the two political parties represented by Bhutto and Sharif, there hasn't been an opportunity for that to kind of grow into a fully fledged democratic society where new parties can come up and create a sizable sort of opposition. We'll have to see. I mean, I think it'll be 2, 3, 4 elections down the line if they are allowed to happen before we see some real kind of fresh faces in Pakistan. Another problem has been that Musharraf, in his holding on of power, is that he has signed coalitions with various Islamist religious parties that historically in Pakistan had never really polled very seriously at all, never won more than 10% of any election. But because he teamed up with them in 2002 and has kept those relationships going up until the present day, and I would hazard a guess that those political parties would form a coalition in January if Musharraf manages to win again, there's been no chance for people to spread their wings and to look for new parties beyond those very limited and archaic established political voices. So it's, as we said before, I mean, is there any way out? Yes, there is a way out, because it's time for genuine democracy to be enabled in Pakistan. And as I said earlier, by ways that are not particularly headline-grabbing or exciting, which is making sure that there are proper political parties and that you're able to form a political party without fear or without being having lots of legal obstacles thrown at you. I mean, Imran Khan, no one really thinks of him as a serious political voice, but at least he's trying.
Well, let's talk with another caller here in Champaign County, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm persuaded by Tariq Ali's analysis in the London Review of Books recently that there's no near way to go to an election. But I wanted to get back to the deception of the book. Is there any documentation, or can you just speculate on what U.S., and this would have been the Reagan-Bush 1 administration, was thinking when they were, you know, letting the Saudis fund the nuclear enterprise in Pakistan? We were obliged to the Saudis in a lot of ways because they were being very helpful in variety of places around the world and funding covert actions and all sorts of things like that. And they're obviously a major economic player. But what can you say something about that?
Well, what we need to also remember is that it wasn't only the Saudis that were funding the Pakistan nuclear program. It was U.S. funding that was going into the Pakistan nuclear program, not directly. I mean, it wasn't coming out of Washington and going straight to the Kahuta laboratories outside Islamabad run by A.Q. Khan, but there was plenty of evidence passed back to Washington over several years that a sizable chunk of the congressional and CIA funding going to fight the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan was being peeled off by the Pakistanis in Islamabad and redirected into the nuclear program. And this was something that numerous officials were concerned about, or it was brought to their attention, including Robert Gates. I remember seeing documentation about him being aware of this situation and being very unhappy about it. But ultimately, nothing could be done that would be seen to upset the Pakistani balance, because they need their goodwill was needed to fight that war. And so there was no attempt to stop money being diverted into the Pakistani nuclear program, and the Pakistani nuclear program was able to reach its fully fledged lengths, going from, if you look at what the situation was in 1981, when the first significant financial deal was done between Reagan and Zia-ul Haq, Pakistan was still years off. Well, it was getting close to enriched uranium to weapons grade, but it was still a long way off industrializing the process. But once the money started flowing in for Afghanistan, then the nuclear program escalated as well, to the point that Pakistan cold tested in 83, it hot tested a weapon in 1984, which was actually a test that was done in China on Pakistan's behalf. And by 1987, it had assembled several nuclear warheads, which it was then in the process of attaching to American-supplied F-16s. And we've got to remember that all through this period, Reagan was required to certify before Congress that Pakistan was not seeking a nuclear weapon, which he did in the full knowledge that Pakistan had not only sought a nuclear weapon, they had a nuclear weapon, they'd attached it to American-supplied F-16, and most of the work had been done with U.S. funding and Saudi funding.
So it's fundamentally the Afghan war leading the Soviets, which actually, in fairness, was sort of espoused by Brzezinski under the Carter administration.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the first American official to suggest that nonproliferation, a gold standard of policy, should be set aside for more immediate strategic ideals was Brzezinski in a memo to Carter in December 1979, when he was writing about Pakistan, saying, look, the Soviet Union has, I'm paraphrasing, the Soviet Union has just marched into Afghanistan. Pakistan is the nearest and closest ally we can possibly have in this situation, because obviously Iran was no longer an ally because the revolution had happened, the Shah had fled, and the US had lost all of its listening stations in Iran. So Brzezinski recommended that possibly non-proliferation would have to take a back seat for the next few years if the US was wanting to fight a war, a proxy war, or at least repel the advances of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and when Brzezinski was asked about the blowback of the whole situation in France some time ago, I guess he said something like, well, we consciously lured them in, that is, the Soviets, into Afghanistan, and that was our plan, and it was worth it, or something. But here we are now. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Welcome. Somebody wants to call real quick. Just let me ask you, is the extent of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal known? Do we know, for example, how many nuclear weapons Pakistan possesses?
Well, because they don't sign up to any international nuclear treaties, and they're not members of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, we can only guess. But the best guesstimates are they have between 24 and 48 assembled warheads, and they have enough highly enriched uranium to put together hundreds, possibly thousands more. I mean, we do know from the research we conducted for the book, we do know that there's an awful lot of fissile material, weapons-grade material, that is missing from the Pakistani nuclear labs, which is something that's extremely alarming. We spent a lot of time with the people who were picked up and put under house arrest with AQ Khan in 2004, and who were now a little more free to speak. And they said that there had been a government audit done in 2004, which showed that there was something like 40 canisters of 6-foot high dimensions, 40 canisters of highly enriched uranium gas, which had gone missing from the labs, and no one knew where they now were, and no one still knows where those canisters are. But we have very limited knowledge about exactly how many warheads they have, where they're kept, and in what state of preparedness or what state of sort of safety they are, because there's a big issue with regard to the sort of security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, something that Fred Kagan has recently been writing about, in that that most countries with nuclear weapons have extremely secure safety procedures and coded switches on warheads, and procedures that involve not just one man to turn around and say, right, I'm going to launch and I'm going to hit Mumbai or New Delhi. But in Pakistan, the evidence is that they don't have very sophisticated safety procedures. And in fact, I think there was an attempt to, by the American government, to provide something called permissive action links, which are switches, which are coded switches to ensure that warheads don't go off by accident. But that sale was banned because of nuclear export U.S. export controls, and also the Pakistanis were very worried that America would keep the codes and then get control of their nuclear warheads.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Catherine Scott Clark, she is an investigative journalist. She works for The Guardian, has been reporting on South Asia for more than 10 years, and along with her colleague, Adrian Levy, they are the authors of the book Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. Walker & Company is the publisher. The book is out now in the bookstores. Ms. Scott Clark, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Have a good day.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to wyll.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, starting the 2008 calendar year with performances by the Royal Philharmonic, the St. Petersburg Ballet, and pianist Christopher Taylor. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
Join us Christmas Day at noon for our traditional broadcast of Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol. Professor Landis read Dickens' classic story every year to UIUC students, and while he's no longer with us, the tradition continues thanks to this recording. Join us at noon Christmas Day for Professor Paul Landis' reading of A Christmas Carol, here on AM 580, WILL, Urbana. Dan Fogelberg was a Peoria native and a University of Illinois student. He was also a talented singer, musician, and songwriter whose career spanned over 30 years before his death on December 16th at age 56. Join Rich Warren for a tribute to Dan Fogelberg, including early recordings from the Red Herring Coffee House in Urbana, December 28th at 2 p.m. and December 31st at 11 a.m. here on AM 580, WILL, Urbana.
Christmas Eve day is partly sunny. We'll see a high of 32, west winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour with gusts to around 25. It'll be partly cloudy tonight, the low 22, then the Christmas Day forecast, mostly sunny, and a high of 37 degrees, south winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, the low 25, and then for Wednesday, clouding up and a chance of snow again, the high temperature around 38 degrees. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings.